Hello and welcome to Unfrozen. I am Dan Safarik. Today's episode is pretty on point for at least for my line of work. We're going to be talking about high rises from the first, let's say, 30 years of American history. With me today is Chris Heitha, lead artist and project founder behind the High Rises Art Deco project, and Mark Hauser. Chris is a designer and a visual artist with a passion for photography and a degree in architecture from Drexel University. His most recent NFT project, Row Homes, captured the urban fabric of his native Philadelphia, which is also the starting point for high rises. And Mark Hauser, on the other side of Pennsylvania, is a Pittsburgh expert on early high rises and author of Multi-Stories, 55 Antique Skyscrapers, and the Business Tycoons Who Built Them. He speaks frequently on the topic and appears in the Curiosity Stream documentary, History by the Numbers, Skyscrapers. Welcome, Chris and Mark.
Hi, Dan.
Hey, Dan. Happy to be here.
Okay, guys. So you've put together a collaboration that is digital. It's also an exhibition, and it's also a book. It's called High Rises, and it's part of a series that Chris, at least, has been working on for a long time on the visual side. And I know that Mark has quite a long history with skyscraper history, as it were. So how did you two come together, and what is this project about?
Yeah, I'll start with that. What is the project about? Well, it's about celebrating these Art Deco skyscrapers, and we can get into a lot of the details. But the main kind of idea maybe is twofold. There's the details way up at the tops of buildings. Oftentimes we experience just the street level detail. And then the top, you only really see it in terms of a skyline view where you can't see all the great details. The other facet is uncovering great buildings that many people might not know about in smaller cities like Lincoln, Nebraska, or Rochester, Minnesota, or Rochester, New York, for that matter. So there's plenty more we'll dive into about the project. And then how Mark and I met. I set off on this project after doing a series of 100 row homes, and I wanted to find another building typology that had great diversity, but also shared a lot of common traits. With row homes, they're a typology where it's like 2 to 3 stories and a certain width. Same with high rises. There's like a consistency to them and then a great variety. So I started the project, and then I really wanted to bring someone on to do history and writing. That's not my strong suit as the artist. And I was just calling around, trying to just talk to other people who have done things relating to skyscrapers from like a legal standpoint. I just wanted to know, like, I don't know if you needed to think about that. So I found Mark just by Googling skyscraper books and gave him a call. He was in Pittsburgh. It just so happened I was going to Pittsburgh to document buildings there. I think it was like the week after I called Mark for the first time that I was going to be in Pittsburgh. So we arranged to hang out, and it just, the pieces kind of clicked. We were both in a place where we wanted to work on something like this. So, I mean, Mark, what was that like from your perspective?
Well, yeah, it was really a perfect coincidence that my first book that you mentioned, Dan, was about the first skyscrapers ever built. So, you know, even before the turn of the century. And I'd been wanting to do a book about Art Deco skyscrapers and the stories behind them. And just looking for an opportunity to do that. And one of the things that I thought was most important is interesting art. You wanted to have great photos of these buildings. And suddenly I get a call from this guy in Philadelphia who is trying a different way to portray these buildings that's never been really done before. And that's Chris's art uses drone scans and basically flies up the side of the building. He'll describe the process to you, but it creates these amazing otherworldly images of these buildings. And it really conveys the energy and the excitement and the feeling of technology and also craftsmanship. And I just thought to have an opportunity to write the stories of the buildings accompanied by really unbelievable art was an opportunity I couldn't pass up. So Chris came out to Pittsburgh, and I want to say we went and looked at a couple of Pittsburgh's classic skyscrapers. We went up on top of one that's by a Chicago favorite, Daniel Burnham, the great architect of the first skyscrapers. And few people know this, even in Pittsburgh, but the tallest skyscraper Burnham ever designed is in Pittsburgh. It's a 25-story building for one of our steel millionaires. And that sort of gets to the point that this whole high-rises collection is about, which is New York and Chicago both have fantastic collections of skyscrapers. No one's doubting that. But every city in America was transformed radically by skyscrapers in the early days. And it's wonderful to get an opportunity to share that knowledge and show people the great buildings that are in cities like Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or anywhere else that isn't the first word out of your mouth when you ask, where are there amazing skyscrapers?
Yeah, I have to say that was one of the most exciting revelations about this whole series. There were buildings that, you know, and I work for this Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat, and there were a number of skyscrapers in there that I wasn't aware of. They were in cities that one, as you say, you don't normally think of, including places like Fort Wayne, Indiana, Lincoln, Nebraska, of course, I guess is semi-famous because of the state capitol. But I guess the question would be then, how did you go about selecting these cities, especially the more, let's say, obscure ones or smaller cities?
Yeah, this was a really fun process. There's no super rigid selection criteria. Like, it's high rises, but we have one in Tulsa that's one story tall. It's like a tower on a warehouse market building. So it was really more about the personality of the buildings. To me, the images are very much like portraits, where the buildings kind of feel alive because it's just the head, the top of the building, and the lighting's consistent and the composition's consistent. So I was looking for buildings that kind of spoke to me, that I could see personified, that like felt like they had kind of a story and some visual interest. And then mainly the way I found these buildings was through Google Earth. It's fascinating to me that Google has like the entire world 3D modeled. Maybe not some of the smaller cities, but any kind of major mid-sized town, city in the US, they have a 3D digital model. So rather than just Googling like Art Deco buildings in the United States, I would spend hundreds of hours just zooming into any place that intersections came together and find a town, find a city, oftentimes without even having labels on. I would just see a little civilization and then look at all of their buildings and find cool ones that I might want to document. That's how I found things like that Fort Wayne building, like Beaumont, Texas, and a handful of others. And it was a very fun kind of scavenger hunt to find these great Art Deco skyscrapers that people aren't really talking about.
Another thing I like about the buildings that Chris has chosen for this collection, and once in a while I get to help with a suggestion or two. There's a couple, like Monadnock in Chicago is one that I suggested. But I love that right from the start, I think this is colored by Chris's earlier work about row houses in Philadelphia, is that, you know, even a building that has good bones, even if its exterior is a little dinged up, that sometimes can make a more compelling image than something brand new and shiny. And I mean, that adds to the character. So I was recently talking with someone who's a building manager out in California for one of the best high rises images, the Eastern Columbia building in Los Angeles. And they're going through this massive renovation of, the colorful terracotta tiles, glazed tiles on the outside, blue and gold. And they loved the image, but they said their one regret is that we didn't feature it after the renovation was done. But when you get to see these buildings, not in a perfect state, but in a state that shows their age and the years that have gone by, I think that actually adds to the appeal. And I love that about the collection. There are several buildings. There are some that have really had some rough years, but it adds to the variety.
Yeah, that's a great point, Mark. That's the trifecta of the points the project tries to hit. And to add to that, I kind of like too when you have the architect's original intent, but then in the images, you can see add-ons, you can see like antennas that are kind of unsightly, but they reflect like how we are treating these buildings now. Back then, they had such a vision. They designed even interior fixtures and like the desk at the front lobby. They were very particular about how these buildings looked. And then 100 years later, we're just slapping antennas on them. And it's okay. You know, there's a need for those things. But I think it makes the images richer sometimes to see how these buildings have evolved over time.
Well, that's a good point about the fact that not all the images are pristine. They're all very evocative, and they have this sort of uncanny depth of field effect where there's sort of like, it almost seems like the photograph of a building facade is like a matte surface in front of varying backgrounds, which really makes all the buildings, regardless of their condition, seem like they have a story to tell, and they always do. So I guess I have a question about methodology. Can you describe a little bit how you get some of these shots? Because they're not quite straight on photographs, but they're not like your typical sort of touched up Photoshop image either.
Yeah, they're kind of something in between. I'll explain the whole process, but the process evolved based on solving a couple problems. So one is a drone, at least the drone I had, the DJI Air 2S, only shoots horizontal photos. You can't rotate the drone and you can't rotate the camera. So if I were to take, and the skyscraper images, they have to be portrait orientation because they're tall, narrow things. It makes sense. Mobile is like the most consumed or most popular way people consume media too. So having vertical photos, that's another point for that. So I couldn't just take a horizontal landscape photo and crop it because the drone just doesn't have good enough resolution to do that. Another thing is sometimes these buildings have another building right across the street that would entirely block the facade. It's literally impossible to get a photo of that facade, let's say, from far away. And both of these things were solved by this strategy of stitching several images together. So essentially, I take a photo at each floor level, and then I manually align all of those photos and stitch them together. So each one of the images is just a part of the building. You're not seeing the top or bottom. It's just kind of one floor, and then the next floor is another image. This also is fun because it makes it more like a architectural elevation because it flattens the whole image, which is an effect that I quite enjoy. And then it's also this like really high res stitch and kind of unique way to present these buildings.
Yeah, the effect is great. And also you've superimposed on a number of the buildings, height figures, which of course, you know, speaks to my world, but also you then have some pull-out details. And I'm wondering what sort of governed the decision to include those details. Was it, you know, that the details were great, or there was too much white space, or too much space that was not an image of the skyscraper itself?
That was more just my background in architecture school. I love architectural representation, and I have a photography side, but I have 6 years of experience, 3 years in the field at a firm and 6 years of school of creating these rich, textured, annotated architectural drawings. And there's a quality to them that I really enjoy. And kind of just that like annotated texture, these layers of information, guidelines, you know, calling out floor heights. I think that just steps it up another level. And it's just for me, I really enjoy the look of that. And I hope too that people, you know, visit the site or see the images and just can appreciate the work that Mark and I had to go through to do those annotations and find the floor levels and have a good caption for a call out.
I'd like to add to that, because when Chris first described to me what he wanted to do with those annotations, my first book, I had gathered some, you know, vital statistics about the buildings I was writing about. And one of the things I found out early on is promoters and developers have different ways of counting floors, right? And certainly in the early days of Scott, you know this well, of course, collecting this data, Dan. And so, you know, your database was very helpful in finding some of this information. But you know that, you know, some of these early skyscrapers, it was not uncommon for the developer to count the basements as floors. And sometimes those upper floors count or don't count, even, you know, when they're mechanical and elevator shafts and so forth. So some people count them and some people don't. And to try to come up with something uniform, I know from the outset, I thought, we want to do this. And Chris, you know, was pretty sure that he wanted to have those annotations, which really add to the illustration. But it led to no small amount of headaches as the researcher for the project of trying to determine. I mean, there were a lot of phone calls to building managers, a lot of back and forth about, no, are you counting this here? I'm going to send you a picture from Google Earth and some lines pointing to the top. And you tell me, is that the 14th floor or do you count that as the 12th floor? What is that floor? And, you know, it was maddening at times. And, you know, even to the point of there's one building. So Chris has to go to all of these buildings because he's photographing them. I've gone to just about all of these buildings myself, too, because I want to see the lobby and describe it. Sometimes we go together. And one of those times was in Chicago. And there is one of the buildings in the collection that's quite tall, Mather Tower, where we wanted to nail down the height and we weren't getting any answers. So we chose to climb the steps and look at the painted numbers on each of the levels to get an idea of exactly what the top floor was. So once in a while that happened. I must say that was an exhausting day, but we somehow made it to the top of that building and got to see how many floors it was.
It's always fascinating to hear how other people have measured tall buildings when they don't have the resources available. I'm wondering if, so I assume that some of the ultimate heights, you know, like height to tip, height to top, where it came from our database, and then you just proportionally scaled it down. Were there cases where you were actually able to obtain historical drawings?
I have drawings for only two buildings in the collection. So the heights, I mean, you know, these aren't drawings that anyone's building from. They're accurate to the nearest foot or two, maybe. Most of the measurements are actually from Google Earth. Another shout out to Google Earth because it's so critical to my process at this point. If you hover your cursor over anywhere in Google Earth, you can get a height reading. So I'll get the height at the entryway of the door and then the height to tip. Or like you said, sometimes we have the roof height and then I can just see what the roof height is on Google. I'll move my cursor down, you know, to the next datum that I want to mark. And it's accurate enough just to add a layer of texture. But again, the dimensions aren't really practical or functional for anything. They're more aesthetic anyway.
Amazing. So Mark, let's hear a little bit about the research process from the textual side, if you will. I obviously have some experience in doing this with your prior book. And one of the things that's really fun about that book and this book is that almost all these buildings have sort of a crazy person behind them. They almost all have some kind of wealthy baron or early entrepreneur who had some wild vision. And oftentimes they have stories of like almost cartoonish upmanship, you know, one-upmanship, where like, well, my brother built a building down the street and I want one that's taller than his. And it's like, that's ridiculous. Adults don't act like that. And then you realize that they do it all the time. And they still do it. And that's how you wind up with people like, you know, Donald Trump. But these guys are considerably, in my view, more interesting than the Donald. And he's operating in their shadow. So what do you think was some of the, what was one of the most interesting stories? And then what was the most difficult one to uncover? And maybe they're not the same story.
Well, I think I love what you say about these one-upmanship stories. There's a building I'm trying to remember in a small town in Michigan where it was brother against brother, where there's, you know, one building, the tallest building in town is built by a brother who's in one industry. Then the other brother was in the auto seat manufacturing business in like 1910. So he's got to build the taller one. There's a lot of buildings like that in Michigan that are one-upmanship. And I mean, there's one in Pittsburgh that's not in the collection, but another one of Daniel Burnham's buildings. His first skyscraper in Pittsburgh for Henry Clay Frick was a spiked skyscraper. Frick ordered it to block the sunlight out of Andrew Carnegie's building, which was next door.
It's literally a frickin' spite scraper.
Yes, it is. So, but about the process to go through it. So for the research, you know, I think too much of the history about these about these structures is lost because it's been so long. And you know, here I started out doing these building or stories about skyscrapers here in Pittsburgh because there were buildings. I've lived here most of my life, and there were gorgeous buildings that I knew nothing about. And so I started to dig into the old newspaper coverage. And really, that is a wealth of information. You can find every time a skyscraper goes up, the person who's behind its construction is being, you know, he's there on the scene, he's giving a speech. And so then you can find out a little bit more about, you know, what that person's background is and how it is that they came to be so powerful and wealthy that they could build a giant skyscraper. I mean, one of my favorite stories is the Woolworth Building, which is one of our New York high rises in the collection. And that's built by a guy who starts off, Frank Woolworth, on a potato farm in upstate New York. And his family owns a potato farm, and he is so desperate not to work in a potato farm that he goes and works for the general store in town. And then he's a terrible clerk, so they stick him in the back room to clean up the, you know, the storage area and give him an extra job on the side, which is setting up displays. And one day he hears about this great display. Actually, they try it in the store where they lay out everything that you can sell for a nickel. And then people don't have to do receipts or check price tags or whatever. Everything's a nickel. And that just excites Frank Woolworth so much that he decides to make a business of stuff that's only a nickel. And lo and behold, give it a couple of decades, he designs things like sales conferences and starts all these Woolworth stores across the country. And pretty soon he has the tallest skyscraper in the world, the Woolworth Building, which is right there at the foot of the Brooklyn Bridge. And I mean, to think that that came out of the profits of nickels and dimes is amazing. And in fact, if you're in the lobby of the Woolworth Building, which is spectacular, probably the best interior in New York City, in my view, there are little sculptures up in the rafters holding up the arches of the lobby of each of the key participants in planning and designing the building. And one of them is Frank Woolworth. And he is, if you look closely, holding a nickel. He's like pinching a little nickel in his hand. It's a caricature. So, I mean, he had a good sense of humor, too, we can see from that. But I mean, all of these buildings have great stories behind them, you properly note. And what I think is exciting about this project is that too often when we learn about architecture, we learn only about the architects. And there are great architect stories for sure in skyscrapers. But there's also the people behind their construction, like you said, often so they could be viewed as crazy or, you know, this is, but at any rate, they're thinking of this building as a legacy. It's going to stand the test of time. When they're gone, it will still be there. And how did they get there in the first place? And what kind of inspiration can we draw from their story? Because they certainly had to deal with technological change and radical adjustments in their businesses. And that's how they got to the positions where they were. And in a lot of cases with the Art Deco buildings, that was fleeting. And, you know, because the Great Depression occurred. So that caused a hard end to this era of these new snazzy skyscrapers. But it's a nice chance to get a snapshot of those personalities and other people involved with the construction. And I just like the opportunity to share that information with the stories to sort of help color in the background to appreciate along with the image itself.
Well, I had the pleasure a couple weeks ago to visit the Price Tower and actually stay in it in Bartlesville, Oklahoma. This was the only true skyscraper that Frank Lloyd Wright had realized for the oil, well, actually an oil pipeline executive by the name of Price, which eventually became, you know, subsumed by the ConocoPhillips company. But wow, you know, not, obviously it's a tour de force as all Frank Lloyd Wright buildings are, but what an unexpected place to find such a building. And in the case, you know, it just reminded me of your story. And of course, we did see some of the buildings in Tulsa on the way there that that you had pointed out in your own book. And you know, I guess the question would be, you know, these are now pretty quiet places. I mean, even some of the bigger cities that were boom towns when these were built, You know, some of them have hit hard times. A lot of them are in the Rust Belt or this, you know, the Great Plains equivalent thereof. Do you feel that these buildings are playing a role in any kind of rejuvenation? Are they being rediscovered? What's the kind of recovery arc, and how does it cross these buildings? You know, as you visit these towns, do you see them embracing them, or are they still sort of largely people don't know what to do with them?
It's a spectrum for sure, and I want to talk about the Sterrick Building in Memphis, Tennessee. Memphis is a great example of a boomtown that, you know, has fallen on hard times, and they have more office space than they need. And the Sterrick Building is, I think, like a 36-story Art Deco tower that was abandoned for like 30 years. Similar story in Providence, Rhode Island, the Superman Building or Industrial Trust Building. They're, you know, they've been talking about plans to bring it back to life for a long time. But back to the Sterrick Building, I had the opportunity to work with the developer. That's one of the two buildings that I have original plans for, which were fascinating to see how they drew them up in the 1920s. But they started an effort to bring that building back, and they have a motivated team to do it. And I think these buildings hold a special place in the hearts of all of these cities, because they're these landmark towers that have been there for nearly 100 years that people have grown to associate with the city. They're very unlike just a new development that might pop up. Also for sustainability, these buildings have a lot that they need, you know, being abandoned for 30 years, they need updated systems, they need to be gutted. But still, historic restoration and using the bones of a building that's already there is always going to be more sustainable than, you know, getting all new steel and stone and glass and concrete. So it's great to bring these buildings back.
Yeah. And I think you may have mentioned in your podcast last week, you were talking with your last episode, that is, with Jason Barr with his new Cities in the Sky book. But I think you brought up Dan Gilbert in Detroit. Detroit's a great example of a city that's recognizing the architectural heritage it has. It's, I mean, particularly with marvelous Art Deco buildings like the Guardian and the Fisher Building, two of the most beautiful, both exterior and interior Art Deco buildings, very innovative. But I mean, the guy who started, you know, Rocket Mortgage, and now through his company Bedrock, they own quite a few of these heritage skyscrapers. And I think the Book Building is one from the pre-Art Deco era that has just been turned into a luxury hotel. But I mean, take a look too in Chicago. You don't have to look too far to find that a lot of these originally office skyscrapers, like the cover of our book, High Rises Art Deco, it features this building that is the Carbide and Carbon Building that was originally built basically for acetylene torch welding company, but is now a luxury hotel. You know, it's quite lovely, and it's such a distinctive structure that you can look throughout the city and find, not just in Chicago too, but in cities across America, these buildings, the earliest high rises, the first skyscrapers through that first pre-World War II time. I mean, they radically changed the cities. They had a meaning then of industry and commerce for the most part. And now they're just heritage. They're a part of the skyline that people, you know, just can't imagine their city without. And now they're being turned into hotels or into residential properties. And the floor plates for these buildings are really, you know, ideally suited for that in many cases. There was another one we saw in Minneapolis that's been made into a hotel. That is one. It's a better crazy person story. It just occurred to me, if I may, but it's called Fauché Tower. I don't know if you've seen this one, but Wilbur Fauché basically is in the power and utility business. He buys up a bunch of small Midwestern utilities, and he's raising money by selling stock in the company in kind of a curious and suspicious way in the 1920s. So he builds this grand tower that is tapered in downtown Minneapolis, is tapered like the Washington Monument. And he says it's going to be the Washington Monument of the Midwest. But unlike Washington's Washington Monument, it also has giant light bulbs on the top on all four sides that have the name Fauché. So Wilbur has his building that says Fauché across it. And this is still, I mean, he went to Leavenworth for 3 years for the mail fraud of building this building. So it had a, you know, not quite the ending he'd hoped for. But now it's the W Hotel in Minneapolis. It's a luxury hotel. You can still go up to the what would have been his luxury offices and is now kind of like a lounge and a lookout and a little museum. But I mean, to me, that's astonishing that I guess, you know, people have come to love it. He was a swindler. He came up with, you know, a building by cheating people. And it is one of the landmark buildings of downtown Minneapolis. And people love it because it looks like nothing else. It's one of my favorite images in the high-rises collection.
Yeah, I am a fan of that one. And it's near neighbor the Rand Tower, which is also converted to a hotel. That is pretty phenomenal Art Deco interiors. And I believe that the Rand in question was somehow involved in aviation because when they went and did the renovation, the themes are very much the Art Deco interpretation of aviation themes. But yeah, I mean, it's great that there's, in any city where there's a market for a boutique hotel, you know, that's a great solution. It's also, you know, there's definitely, if you subdivide, you know, 25-story office building into, you know, what becomes ultimately a 15-story or with several double height residences, you know, I think there's a pretty strong market for that. I wonder if there is, have you seen a case where the conversion of the building kind of precedes the conversion of the rest of the surrounding downtown? In other words, it becomes the catalyst for regeneration as opposed to following the regeneration that was already occurring.
One that comes to mind is in Kansas City, that is another beautiful Art Deco, and that is the Power and Light building. I mean, this is like obviously the power company in Kansas City's headquarters, and it was one of the tallest buildings in, you know, middle America for many years. But what strikes me about it is in Kansas City, their entire downtown entertainment district is called the Power and Light District. So, I mean, that's recognizing that this building is a centerpiece. It's now apartments. I think it's gone through a couple transformations. But, I mean, you know, it's like the Flatiron District in New York.
Yeah, I mean, I think the landmarks in some cases make the neighborhood and always have, regardless of what state the landmark happens to be in the present day. So you guys just had an exhibition. And you're having it again at the Chicago Architecture Center. Maybe you can talk a bit about that.
Yeah, I'd love to take that. Now that the work for documenting these buildings is coming to a close after like 2 years of traveling and seeing all of these buildings, it's really fun to refocus on just getting the word out and sharing all the work that we've been doing for the past couple of years. So exhibitions are a great way to do that because of how high resolution the images are. Seeing them on your phone or on the website isn't the best way to experience them. So huge prints, seeing them in person is just really fun. And as an artist, printing work is just always superior and a fun opportunity. So I did my first exhibition of the work at the Philadelphia Architecture Center in December. It's like November 15th to December 15th. And that was my first experience like designing a whole exhibition, like, you know, putting together all the prints, sourcing them, getting sponsors, organizing an event, which was all new to me. And that kind of gave me the confidence to bring it to the Chicago Architecture Center with some proof of like, hey, I can pull this off. And the timing just worked out really great. And it's been wonderful to work with the folks over there. The first show is a pop-up. There was a gap between two large exhibitions in their main skyscraper gallery, which is a massive space, like too big to really fill with this project. So very quickly, we put together a show that was up for a month that was mostly just a bunch of big prints and the info. And then for the past few months, we've been working on designing a longer term show that'll be up for 3 months over the summer, where we have a bigger budget to do more fun things and spend more time on the design and the materials, and we're really excited to get it up.
And when does that open for those who might be in the area?
It's planned to open May 31st, and it'll be open until, I believe, August 26th, around then. So all summer long, go do the boat tour. They're incredible in Chicago, and then check out the exhibition.
And we'll be coming out, too, for a book talk and a celebration signing, like a gallery party, on Thursday, July 18th. We're also talking at the New York Art Deco Society New York next month. That'll be both in person and a Zoom call. But I wanted to say another thing is, I mean, I hope people come out to see the exhibition. But if you'd like to search and see what buildings from your city are in the collection, it's pretty easy to do. So you just go to the website, highrisescollection.com. We have recently added we've gotten up to now our target number of 200 skyscrapers. This is from 30 different states, coast to coast, 68, I think, cities. So cities as, you know, as big as New York and Chicago and LA, but also tiny cities like Rochester, Minnesota, or Jackson, Mississippi. And of course, Pittsburgh and Philadelphia get to play a role. Tons of Chicago buildings. I think 16 buildings from Chicago. So that's the biggest. And you can search through all of these. They're all available on your phone or on your computer. You can see all of the images. You can read all the histories. You can even sort them if you only want to see the buildings from the Midwest, or you only want to see the buildings from the 1910s, or from just the buildings from Chicago. There's a whole bunch of fun ways that you can sort through these and get to compare them, which I think is a fun feature that, you know, you don't have to come to the Chicago Architecture Center to see them. You could see them from wherever your listeners are listening.
And I'd also mention that you can download some packages of images as backgrounds for your phone, which I have done. And I have the Carbon and Carbide building here, otherwise known as the Pendry Hotel, as my screensaver. And I try to switch them out every month because I think as you get like a pack of 10, and then you can flick through them and just, you know, change the scenery if you like.
Yeah, that was a fun thing that I stumbled into. One, like I said, the vertical format is perfect for these skyscrapers, and then it works perfect for a foam wallpaper. The symmetry of it and Iowa 16, the building is like cut out and the text is behind it. Yeah, kind of like the book cover is formatted where it's like kind of like three-dimensional. But this is kind of just a more conceptual thing. At first, wallpapers seem like such a, I don't know, kind of a weird product to sell, like a digital product. But then I realized that your phone wall screen, your phone wallpaper is kind of the most prime real estate in someone's life, more so than a print on your wall, because I think there's a stat where people check their phone like 200 times a day or probably more. So I just love to think of like the conversations that could start, just, you know, enjoying these historic buildings. So
I've got, the Buffalo City Hall. I've had it. It's just a gorgeous Art Deco, just the colors in this, and the interior is amazing. Uh-oh.
Which one is that on yours, Chris?
It's an AI skyscraper. This is another evolution, but I really want to bring this one to life.
No fair.
Design it, because I could use my images to prompt AI, specifically Midjourney, and it would follow the visual style that I established for the project, and just create new buildings based on, you know, the feedback that I was giving it. And they're really impressive. And then it's my job as a designer to take that inspiration and like 3D model it and refine the details. And so that's one that I've been wanting to bring to life.
And of course, I should say that the phone screens are really wonderful. Those people who are old fashioned and would like to have a print or coffee table book with 100 Art Deco skyscrapers, that's also something that's been pretty successful and people seem to really enjoy. It's a supersized Art Deco book. I think you've seen it, Dan. It's heavy enough to hold down, you know, it'll take its place on a coffee table and take up most of that area.
It actually is lying sideways on my shelf because it won't go vertically. It's too tall. So it has a place of pride as a kind of the bedrock of a number of other books that are also oversized. No, it's gorgeous. It's a gorgeous book, and the synchronicity between all of your outputs is really quite nice. Clearly, there's some integrated thinking going on between all the products that are coming out of this, which I think is very much of a piece with the architects who designed all the furniture and doorknobs and fixtures in these buildings, in addition to their overall form. It's almost like carrying on in that tradition. So I commend both of you for your attention to detail and history and your willingness to, you know, perpetuate it into the digital age. So that's Mark Hauser and Chris Heitha. They have a exhibit and a book and a website and NFTs and digital wallpaper for your phone of high rises. This current crop is Art Deco, but they have an entire collection of something like 200 of these high resolution rendered images for you to consume and to query and question. I want to thank you both for being on Unfrozen today, and hope to catch you when you're in Chicago.
Thanks, Dan. It's been great.